slower than light. Frozen with the cattle embryos and orange juice concentrate and feeder viruses on a trip that took 129 shipboard years, with an objective time debt of 167 standard years. Mother figured that the accrued interest on the long-term accounts would be enough to pay off our family debt and perhaps allow me to survive comfortably for a while. For the first and last time in her life, Mother figured wrong. Notes for a sketch of Heaven's Gate. Mud lanes, which run back from the station's conversion docks like a pattern of sores on a leper's back. Sulphurous brown clouds, which hang in tatters from a rotten burlap sky. A tangle of shapeless wooden structures half decayed before they were ever fully constructed. Their painless windows, now staring sightlessly into the gaping mouths of their neighbors. Indigenes breeding like humans, I suppose. Eyeless cripples, lungs burned out with air rot. Squiring a nest of a dozen offspring. The children's skin, scabrous by age 5 standard. Their eyes, watering incessantly from the sting of an atmosphere which will kill them before they're 40. Their smiles, carious. Their oily hair rife with lice and the blood bags of Dracula ticks. Proud parents, beaming. 20 million of these doomed schmucks crowded into slums, overflowing an island, smaller than my family's west lawn on old Earth. All of them fighting to breathe the only breathable air on a world where the standard is to inhale and die. Crowding ever closer to the center of the 60-mile radius of survivable atmosphere, which the atmospheric generating station had been able to provide before it began to malfunction. Heaven's Gate, my new home. Mother had not taken into account the possibility that all old Earth accounts would be frozen, and then appropriated into the growing world web economy, nor had she remembered that the reason people had waited for the Hawking Drive to see the spiral arm of the galaxy is that in long-term cryogenic sleep, as opposed to a few weeks or months of fugue, chances of terminal brain damage were 1 in 6. I was lucky. When I was uncrated on Heaven's Gate and put to work digging out acid canals beyond the perimeter, I had suffered only a cerebral accident, a stroke. Physically, I was able to work in the mud pits within a few local weeks. Mentally, there was much left to be desired. The left side of my brain had been shut down, like a damaged section of a spinship being sealed off, airtight doors leaving the doomed compartments open to vacuum. I could still think. Control of the right side of my body soon returned. Only the language centers had been damaged beyond simple repair. Marvelous organic computer wedged in my skull had dumped its language content like a flawed program. The right hemisphere was not without some language, but only the most emotionally charged units of communication could lodge in that affective hemisphere. My vocabulary was now down to 9 words. This, I learned later, was exceptional. Many victims of CVAs retain only 2 or 3. For the record, here is my entire vocabulary of manageable words. Fuck, shit, piss, cunt, goddamn, motherfucker, asshole, peepee, and poopoo. A quick analysis will show some redundancy here. I had at my disposal 8 nouns, which stood for 6 things. 5 of the 8 nouns could double as verbs. I retained 1 indisputable noun and a single adjective, which also could be used as a verb or expletive. My new language universe was comprised of 4 monosyllables, 3 compound words, and 2 baby talk repetitions. My arena of literal expression offered 4 avenues to the topic of elimination, 2 references to human anatomy, 1 request for divine imprecation, 1 standard description of or request for coitus, and a coital variation which was no longer an option for me since my mother was deceased. All in all, it was enough. I will not say that I remember my 3 years in the mud pits and slime slums of Heaven's Gate with fondness, but it is true that these years were at least as formative as, and probably more so, than my previous 2 decades on old Earth. I soon found that among my intimate acquaintances, Old Sludge, the scoop shovel foreman, Unk, the slumyard bully to whom I paid my protection bribes, Kitty, the lice-ridden crib doxy whom I slept with when I could afford it, my vocabulary served me well. Shitfuck, I would grunt, gesticulating. Asshole cunt peepee fuck. Ah, grinned Old Sludge, showing his one tooth. Going to the company store to get some algae chewies, huh? Goddamn poo-poo, I would grin back at him. The life of a poet lies not merely in the finite language dance of expression, but in the nearly infinite combinations of perception and memory, combined with the sensitivity to what is perceived and remembered. My 3 local years on Heaven's Gate, almost 1,500 standard days, allowed me to see, to feel, to hear, to remember, as if I literally had been born again. Little matter that I had been born again in hell. Reworked experience is the stuff of all true poetry, and raw experience was the birthing gift of my new life. There was no problem adapting to a brave new world 1.5 centuries beyond my own. For all of our talk of expansion and pioneering spirit these past 5 centuries, we all know how stultified and static our human universe has become. We are in a comfortable, dark ages of the inventive mind. Institutions change but little, and that by gradual evolution rather than revolution. Scientific research creeps crab-like in a lateral shuffle, where once it leaped in great intuitive bounds. Devices change even less. Plateau technologies common to us would be instantly identifiable and operable to our great-grandfathers. So while I slept, the hegemony became a formal entity, the world web was spun to something close to its final shape, the all-thing took its democratic place among the list of humanity's benevolent despots, the Technocore seceded from human service and then offered its help as an ally rather than a slave, and the ousters retreated to darkness and the role of nemesis. But all these things had been creeping toward critical mass even before I was frozen into my ice coffin between the pork bellies and sherbet. Such obvious extensions of old trends took little effort to understand. Besides, history, viewed from the inside, is always a dark, digestive mess, far different from the easily recognizable cow viewed from afar by historians. My life was Heaven's Gate, and the minute-to-minute demands of survival there. The sky was always an eternal yellow-brown sunset hanging like a collapsing ceiling mere meters above my shack. My shack was oddly comfortable. A table for eating, a cot for sleeping and fucking, a hole for pissing and shitting, and a window for silent staring. My environment mirrored my vocabulary. Prison always has been a good place for writers, killing as it does the twin demons of mobility and diversion, and Heaven's Gate was no exception. The atmospheric protectorate owned my body, but my mind, or what was left of it, was mine. On old Earth, my poetry was composed on a Sedu Dekanar Comlog thought processor while I lounged in a padded chaise lounge, or floated in my EM barge above dark lagoons, or walked pensively through scented bowers. The execrable, undisciplined, limp-wristed, flatulent products of those reveries already have been described. On Heaven's Gate, I discovered what a mental stimulant physical labor could be. Not mere physical labor, I should add, but absolutely spine-bending, lung-racking, gut-ripping, ligament-tearing, and ball-breaking physical labor. But as long as the task is both onerous and repetitive, I discovered, the mind is not only free to wander to more imaginative climes, it actually flees to higher planes. Thus, on Heaven's Gate, as I dredged bottom scum from the slop canals under the red gaze of Vega Primo, or crawled on hands and knees through stalactites and stalagmites of rebreather bacteria in the station's labyrinthine lung pipes, I became a poet. All I lacked were the words. The 20th century's most honored writer, William Gass, once said in an interview, "Words are the supreme objects. They are minded things." And so they are. As pure and transcendent as any idea which ever cast a shadow in Plato's dark cave of our perceptions. But they are also pitfalls of deceit and misperception. Words bend our thinking to infinite paths of self-delusion. And the fact that we spend most of our mental lives in brain mansions built of words means that we lack the objectivity necessary to see the terrible distortion of reality which language brings. Example. The Chinese pictogram for honesty is a two-part symbol of a man literally standing next to his word. So far, so good. But what does the late English word integrity mean? Or motherland? Or progress, or democracy, or beauty. But even in our self-deception, we become gods. A philosopher-mathematician named Bertrand Russell, who lived and died in the same century as Gass, once wrote, "Language serves not only to express thought, but to make possible thoughts which could not exist without it. Here is the essence of mankind's creative genius. Not the edifices of civilization, nor the bang-flash weapons which can end it, but the words which fertilize new concepts, like spermatozoa attacking an ovum." It might be argued that the Siamese twin infants of word/idea are the only contribution the human species can, will, or should make to the raveling cosmos. Yes, our DNA is unique, but so is a salamander's. Yes, we construct artifacts, but so have species ranging from beavers to the architect ants whose crenellated towers are visible right now off the port bow. Yes, we weave real fabric things from the dream stuff of mathematics, but the universe is hardwired with arithmetic. Scratch a circle, and pi peeps out. Enter a new solar system, and Tycho Brahe's formulae lie waiting under the black velvet cloak of space-time. But where has the universe hidden a word under its outer layer of biology, geometry, or insensate rock? Even the traces of other intelligent life we have found, the blimps on Jove II, the labyrinth builders, the Senescii empaths on Hebron, the stick people of Durulus, the architects of the time tombs, the Shrike itself, have left us mysteries and obscure artifacts. But no language. No words. The poet John Keats once wrote to a friend of his named Bailey, "I am certain of nothing but the holiness of the heart's affection and the truth of imagination. What the imagination seizes as beauty must be truth, whether it existed before or not." The Chinese poet George Wu, who died in the last Sino-Japanese War about 3 centuries before the Hegira, understood this when he recorded on his comm log, "Poets are the mad midwives to reality. They see not what is, nor what can be, but what must become." Later on his last disc, to his lover the week before he died, Wu said, "Words are the only bullets in truth's bandolier, and poets are the snipers." You see, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh in the weave of the human universe, and only the poet can expand this universe, finding shortcuts to new realities the way the Hawking Drive tunnels under the barriers of Einsteinian space-time. To be a poet, I realized, a true poet, was to become the avatar of humanity incarnate. To accept the mantle of poet is to carry the cross of the Son of Man, to suffer the birth pangs of the soul mother of humanity. To be a true poet is to become God. I tried to explain this to my friends on Heaven's Gate. "Piss shit," I said. "Asshole, motherfucker, goddamn shit, goddamn cunt. Peepee cunt, goddamn." They shook their heads and smiled and walked away. Great poets are rarely understood in their own day. The yellow-brown clouds rained acid on me. I waded in mud up to my thighs and cleaned leechweed from the city sewer pipes. Old Sludge died during my second year there. When we were all working on a project extending the First Avenue Canal to the Midsump mudflats. An accident. He was climbing a slime dune to rescue a single sulfur rose from the advancing grouter when there was a mudquake. Kati married shortly after that. She still worked part-time as a crib doxy, but I saw less and less of her. She died in childbirth shortly after the green tsunami carried away Mudflat City. I continued to write poetry. How is it, you might ask, that someone can write fine verse with a vocabulary of only 9 right hemisphere words? The answer is that I used no words at all. Poetry is only secondarily about words. Primarily, it is about truth. I dealt with the Ding an sich, the substance behind the shadow, weaving powerful concepts, similes, and connections the way an engineer would raise a skyscraper with the whiskered alloy skeleton being constructed long before the glass and plastic and chrome aluminum appears. And slowly the words returned. The brain retains and retools itself amazingly well. What had been lost in the left hemisphere found a home elsewhere, or reasserted their primacy in the damaged regions, like pioneers returning to a fire-damaged plain made more fertile by the flames. Where before a simple word like salt would leave me stuttering and gasping, my mind probing emptiness like a tongue, prodding the socket of a missing tooth. Now, the words and phrases flowed back slowly, like the names of forgotten playmates. During the day, I labored in the slime fields, but at night, I sat at my splintered table and wrote my contus by the light of a hissing ghee lamp. Mark Twain once opined in his homey way, "The difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug." He was droll, but incomplete. During those long months of beginning my contos on Heaven's Gate, I discovered that the difference between finding the right word as opposed to accepting the almost right word was the difference between being struck by lightning and merely watching a lightning display. So my contos began and grew. Written on the flimsy sheets of recycled leechweed fiber, which they issued by the ton for use as toilet paper, scribbled by one of the cheap felt-tip pens sold at the company store, the contos took shape. As the words returned, slipping into place like once scattered pieces of a 3D puzzle, I needed a form. Returning to Don Balthazar's teachings, I tried on the measured nobility of Milton's epic verse. Gaining confidence, I added the romantic sensuality of a Byron matured by a Keatsish celebration of the language. Stirring all this, I seasoned the mixture with a dash of Yeats' brilliant cynicism and a pinch of Pound's obscure scholastic arrogance. I chopped, diced, and added such ingredients as Eliot's control of imagery, Dylan Thomas's feel for place, Delmore Schwartz's sense of doom, Steve Thames' touch of horror, Salmod Brevi's plea for innocence, Dayton's love of the convoluted rhyme scheme, Wu's worship of the physical, and Edmund Key Ferrera's radical playfulness. In the end, of course, I threw this entire mixture out and wrote the contos in a style all my own. If it had not been for Unk, the slumyard bully, I probably still would be on Heaven's Gate, digging acid canals by day and writing contos by night. It was my day off, and I was carrying my contos, the only copy of my manuscript, to the company library in the common hall to do some research, when Unk and two of his cronies appeared from an alley and demanded immediate payment of the next month's protection money. We had no universal cards in the Heaven's Gate Atmospheric Protectorate. We paid our debts in company scrip or bootleg marks. I had neither. Unk demanded to see what was in my plastic shoulder bag. Without thinking, I refused. It was a mistake. If I'd shown Unk the manuscript, he most probably would have scattered it in the mud and slapped me around after making threats. As it was, my refusal angered him, so he and his two Neanderthal companions tore open the bag, scattered the manuscript in the mud, and beat me within the proverbial inch of my life. It so happened that on this day, an EMV belonging to a protectorate air quality control manager was passing low above, and the wife of the manager, traveling alone to the Ark's company residential store, ordered the EMV down, had her android servant retrieve me, and what was left of my contos, and then personally drove me to the company hospital. Normally, the members of the bonded workforce received medical aid, if any, at the walk-in bioclinic, but the hospital did not want to refuse the wife of a manager, so I was admitted, still unconscious, and watched over by a human doctor and the manager's wife while I recovered in a healing tank. All right, to make a banal long story into a banal short story, I'll cut to the uplink. Helenda, that was the manager's wife, read my manuscript while I was floating in renewal nutrient. She liked it. on the same day I was being decanted in the company hospital, Helena farcast to Renaissance, where she showed my Kantos to her sister Philia, who had a friend whose lover knew an editor at Transline Publishing. When I awoke the next day, my broken ribs had been set, my shattered cheekbone had been healed, my bruises were gone, and I'd received 5 new teeth, a new cornea for my left eye, and a contract with Transline. My book came out 5 weeks later. A week after that, Helena divorced her manager and married me. It was her 7th marriage, my first. We honeymooned on the concourse, and when we returned a month later, my book had sold more than 1 billion copies, the first book of verse to hit the bestseller lists in 4 centuries. And I was a millionaire many times over. Tarenna Wingreen Fief was my first editor at Transline. It was her idea to title the book The Dying Earth. A records search showed a novel by that name 500 years earlier, but the copyright had lapsed and the book was out of print. It was her idea to publish just the sections of the Kantos which dealt with the nostalgic final days of Old Earth. And it was her idea to remove the sections which she thought would bore the readers. The philosophical passages, the descriptions of my mother, the sections which paid homage to earlier poets, the places where I played with experimental verse, the more personal passages. Everything, in fact, except the descriptions of the idyllic final days, which, emptied of all heavier freight, came across as sentimental and insipid. 4 months after publication, The Dying Earth had sold 2.5 billion hardfax copies. An abridged and digitalized version was available on the Seething Datasphere, and it had been optioned for the Hollies. Tarenna pointed out that the timing had been perfect, that the original trauma shock of the death of Old Earth had meant a century of denial, almost as if Earth had never existed, followed by a period of revived interest culminating in the Old Earth nostalgia cults, which could now be found on every world in the web. A book, even a book of verse, dealing with the final days, had struck at precisely the right moment. For me, the first few months of life as a celebrity in the hegemony were far more disorienting than my earlier transition from spoiled son of Old Earth to enslaved stroke victim on Heaven's Gate. During those first months, I did book and fax signing on more than 100 worlds. I appeared on the All Net Now show with Marmon Hamlet. I met CEO Sinister Perot and All Things speaker Drury Fine, as well as a score of senators. I spoke to the Interplanetary Society of Penwomen and to the Lussus Writers Union. I was given honorary degrees at the University of New Earth and at Cambridge, too. I was feted, interviewed, imaged, reviewed favorably, bioed, unauthorized, lionized, serialized, and swindled. It was a busy time. Notes for a sketch of life in the hegemony. My home has 38 rooms on 36 worlds. No doors. The arched entrances are farcaster portals. A few opaqued with privacy curtains. Most open to observation and entry. Each room has windows everywhere, and at least 2 walls with portals. From the grand dining hall on Renaissance Vector, I can see the bronze skies and the verdigris towers of Keep Enable in the valley below my volcanic peak. And by turning my head, I can look through the farcaster portal and across the expanse of white carpet in the formal living area to see the Edgar Allan Sea crash against the spires of Point Prospero on Nevermore. My library looks out on the glaciers and green skies of Nordholm, while a walk of 10 paces allows me to descend a short stairway to my tower study, a comfortable, open room encircled by polarized glass, which offers a 360-degree view of the highest peaks of the Kushpat Karakoram, a mountain range 2,000 kilometers from the nearest settlement in the easternmost reaches of the Jamnu Republic on Deneb Dry. The huge sleeping room Helenda and I share rocks gently in the boughs of a 300-meter world tree on the Templar world of God's Grove, and connects to a solarium which sits alone on the arid salt flats of Hebron. Not all of our views are of wilderness. The media room opens to a skimmer pad on the 138th floor of a Tau Ceti Center arc tower, and our patio lies on a terrace overlooking the market in the old section of bustling New Jerusalem. The architect, a student of the legendary Milan de Havre, has incorporated several small jokes into the house's design. The steps go down to the tower room, of course, but equally droll is the exit from the area which leads to the exercise room on the lowest level of Lussus's deepest hive. Or perhaps the guest bathroom, which consists of toilet, bidet, sink, and shower stall on an open, wall-less raft afloat on the violet sea world of Mare Infinitus. At first, the shifts in gravity from room to room were disturbing, but I soon adapted, subconsciously bracing myself for the drag of Lussus and Hebron and Sol Draconi Septim, unconsciously anticipating the less than one standard G freedom of the majority of the rooms. In the 10 standard months Helenda and I are together, we spend little time in our home, preferring instead to move with friends among the resorts and vacation arcologies and night spots of the world web. Our friends are the former Farcaster set, now calling themselves the Caribou Herd, after an extinct Old Earth migratory mammal. This herd consists of other writers, a few successful visual artists, concourse intellectuals, all-thing media representatives, a few radical arnists and cosmetic gene splicers, web aristocrats, wealthy Farcaster freaks and flashback addicts, a few Holly and stage directors, scattering of actors and performance artists, several mafia dons gone straight, and a revolving list of recent celebrities, myself included. Everyone drinks, uses stims and auto implants, takes the wire and can afford the best drugs. The drug of choice is flashback. It is definitely an upper-class vice. One needs the full range of expensive implants to fully experience it. Helenda has seen to it that I have been so fitted. Biomonitors, sensory extenders, an internal comm log, neural shunts, kickers, metacortex processors, blood chips, RNA tapeworms. My mother wouldn't have recognized my insides. I try flashback twice. The first time is a glide. I target my 9th birthday party and hit it with the first salvo. It is all there. The servants singing on the north lawn at daybreak. Don Balthazar grudgingly canceling classes so I can spend the day with Amalfi in my EMV. Streaking across the gray dunes of the Amazon basin in gay abandon. The torchlight procession that evening, as representatives of the other old families arrive at dusk, their brightly wrapped presents gleaming under the moon, and the 10,000 lights. I rise from 9 hours in flashback with a smile on my face. The second trip almost kills me. I am 4, and crying, seeking my mother through endless rooms, smelling of dust and old furniture. Android servants seek to console me, but I shake off their hands, running down hallways soiled with shadows and the soot of too many generations. Breaking the first rule I ever learned, I throw open the doors to Mother's sewing room, her sanctum sanctorum, to which she retires for 3 hours every afternoon, and from which she emerges with her soft smile, the hem of her pale dress whispering across the carpet, like an echo of a ghost's sigh. Mother is sitting there, in the shadows. I am 4, and my finger has been hurt, and I rush to her, throwing myself into her arms. She does not respond. One of her elegant arms remains reclined along the back of the chaise lounge, the other remains limp on the cushion. I pull back, shocked by her cool plasticity. I tug open the heavy velvet drapes without rising from her lap. Mother's eyes are white, rolled back in her head. Her lips are slightly open. Drool moistens the corners of her mouth and glints on her perfect chin. From the gold threads of her hair, done up in the grande dame style she favors, I see the cold steel gleam of the stim wire and the duller sheen of the skull socket she has plugged it into. The patch of bone on either side is very white. On the table, near her left hand, lies the empty flashback syringe. The servants arrive and pull me away. Mother never blinks. I am pulled, screaming from the room. I wake, screaming. Perhaps it was my refusal to use flashback again, which hastened Helena's departure, but I doubt it. I was a toy to her, a primitive who amused her by my innocence about a life she had taken for granted for many decades. Whatever the case, my refusal to flashback left me with many days without her. The time spent in replay is real time, and flashback users often die, having spent more days of their lives under the drug than they ever experienced conscious. At first, I entertained myself with the implants and techno-toys which had been denied to me as a member of an old Earth family. The datasphere was a construct delight that first year. I called up information almost constantly, living in a frenzy of full interface. I was as addicted to raw data as the caribou herd were to their stims and drugs. I could imagine Don Balthazar spinning in his molten grave as I gave up long-term memory for the transient satisfaction of implant omniscience. It was only later that I felt the loss. Fitzgerald's Odyssey, Woo's Final March, and a score of other epics, which had survived my stroke, now were shredded like cloud fragments in a high wind. Much later, freed of implants, I painstakingly learned them all again. For the first and only time in my life, I became political. Days and nights would pass with me monitoring the Senate on Farcaster cable, or lying tapped into the All-Thing. Someone once estimated that the All-Thing deals with about 100 active pieces of hegemony legislation per day, and during my months spent screwed into the sensorium, I missed none of them. My voice and name became well known on the debate channels. No bill was too small, no issue too simple or too complex for my input. The simple act of voting every few minutes gave me a false sense of having accomplished something. I finally gave up the political obsession only after I realized that accessing the All Thing regularly meant either staying home or turning into a walking zombie. A person constantly busy accessing on his implants makes a pitiful sight in public. and it didn't take Helena's derision to make me realize that if I stayed home, I would turn into an all-things sponge like so many millions of other slugs around the web. So, I gave up politics. But by then, I had found a new passion. Religion. I joined religions. Hell, I helped create religions. The Zen Gnostic Church was expanding exponentially, and I became a true believer, appearing on HTV talk shows and searching for my places of power with all the devoutness of a pre-Hijra Muslim pilgrimaging to Mecca. Besides, I loved farcasting. I had earned almost 100 million marks from royalties for the dying earth, and Helena had invested well, but someone once figured that a farcaster home such as mine cost more than 50,000 marks a day just to keep in the web, and I did not limit my farcasting to the 36 worlds of my home. Transline Publishing had qualified me for a gold universal card, and I used it liberally, farcasting to unlikely corners of the web, and then spending weeks staying in luxury accommodations and leasing EMVs to find my places of power in remote areas of backwater worlds. I found none. I renounced Zen Gnosticism about the same time Helena divorced me. By that time, the bills were piling up, and I had to liquidate most of the stocks and long-term investments remaining to me after Helena had taken her share. I was not only naive and in love when she had had her attorneys draw up the marriage contract, I was stupid. Eventually, even with such economies as cutting down my farcasting and dismissing the android servants, I was facing financial disaster. I went to see Tarenna Wingreen Fief. "No one wants to read poetry," she said, leafing through the thin stack of cantos I had written in the past year and a half. "What do you mean?" I said. "The Dying Earth was poetry." "The Dying Earth was a fluke," said Tarenna. Her nails were long and green and curved in the latest Mandarin fashion. They curled around my manuscript like the claws of some chlorophyll beast. "It sold because the mass subconscious was ready for it." "Well, maybe the mass subconscious is ready for this," I said. I was beginning to get angry. Tarenna laughed. It was not an altogether pleasant sound. "Martin, Martin, Martin," she said, "this is poetry. You're writing about Heaven's Gate and the caribou herd, but what comes across is loneliness, displacement, angst, and a cynical look at humanity."
"So?"
"So no one wants to pay for a look at another person's angst," laughed Tarenna. I turned away from her desk and walked to the far side of the room. Her office took up the entire 435th floor of the Transline Spire in the Babel section of Tau Ceti Center. There were no windows. The circular room was open from floor to ceiling, shielded by a solar-generated containment field which showed no shimmer whatsoever. It was like standing between two gray plates suspended halfway between the sky and earth. I watched crimson clouds move between the lesser spires half a kilometer below, and I thought about hubris. Tarenna's office had no doorways, stairways, elevators, field lifts, or trapdoors, no connection to the other levels at all. One entered Tarenna's office through the five-faceted farcaster, which shimmered in midair like an abstract holosculpture. I found myself thinking about tower fires and power failures, as well as hubris. I said, "Are you saying that you won't publish it?" "Not at all," smiled my editor. "You've earned Transline several billion marks, Martin. We will publish it. All I'm saying is that no one will buy it." "You're wrong," I shouted. "Not everyone recognizes fine poetry, but there are still enough people who read to make it a bestseller." Tarenna did not laugh again, but her smile slashed upward in a twist of green lips. "Martin, Martin, Martin," she said. "The population of literate people has been declining steadily since Gutenberg's day. By the 20th century, less than 2% of the people in the so-called industrialized democracies read even one book a year, and that was before the smart machines, data spheres, and user-friendly environments. By the Hegira, 98% of the hegemony's population had no reason to read anything, so they didn't bother learning how to. It's worse today. There are more than 100 billion human beings in the world web, and less than 1% of them bothers to hard fax any printed material, much less read a book. The Dying Earth sold almost 3 billion copies, I reminded her. Mm-hmm, said Serena. It was the Pilgrim's Progress effect.
The what?
Pilgrim's Progress effect. In the Massachusetts colony of, what was it, 17th century old Earth, every decent family had to have a copy in the household. But my heavens, no one had to read it. It was the same with Hitler's Mein Kampf, or Stukatsky's Visions in the Eye of a Decapitated Child.
Who was Hitler, I said.
Terenna smiled slightly. An old Earth politician who did some writing. Mein Kampf is still in print. Transline renews the copyright every 138 years.
Well, look, I said, I'm going to take a few weeks to polish up the Kantos and give it my best shot.
Fine, smiled Terenna. I suppose you'll want to edit it the way you did last time.
Not at all, said Terenna.
Since there's no core of nostalgia this time, you might as well write it the way you want.
I blinked.
You mean, I can keep in the blank verse this time?
Of course.
And the philosophy?
Please do.
And the experimental sections?
Yes.
And you'll print it the way I write it?
Absolutely.
Is there a chance it'll sell?
Not a hope in hell.
My few weeks to polish up the Kantos turned into 10 months of obsessive labor. I shut off most of the rooms in the house, keeping only the tower room on Deneb Dry, the exercise room on Lussus, the kitchen, and the bathroom raft on Mare Infinitus. I worked a straight 10 hours a day, took a break for some vigorous exercise, followed by a meal and a nap, and then returned to my writing table for another 8-hour stint. It was similar to the time 5 years before when I was recovering from my stroke, and it sometimes took an hour or a day for a word to come to me, for a concept to sink its roots into the firm soil of language. Now it was an even slower process as I agonized over the perfect word, the precise rhyme scheme, the most playful image, and the most ineffable analog to the most elusive emotion. After 10 standard months, I was done, acknowledging the ancient aphorism to the effect that no book or poem is ever finished, merely abandoned.
"What do you think?" I asked Terenna as she read through the first copy.
Her eyes were blank bronze discs in that week's fashion, but this did not hide the fact that there were tears there. She brushed one away.
"It's beautiful," she said.
"I tried to rediscover the voice of some of the ancients," I said, suddenly shy.
"You succeeded brilliantly."
"The Heaven's Gate interlude is still rough," I said.
"It's perfect."
"It's about loneliness," I said.
"It is loneliness."
"Do you think it's ready?" I asked.
"It's perfect. A masterpiece."
"Do you think it'll sell?" I asked.
"No fucking way."
They planned an initial run of 70 million hard fax copies of Kantos. Transline ran ads throughout the datasphere, placed HTV commercials, transmitted software inserts, successfully solicited blurbs from best-selling authors, made sure it was reviewed in the new New York Times book section and the TC2 review, and generally spent a fortune on advertising. The Kantos sold 23,000 hard fax copies during the first year it was in print. At 10% royalties of the 12MK cover price, I earned back 13,800 MK of my 2 million MK advance from Transline. The second year saw a sale of 638 hard fax copies. There were no Datasphere rights sold, no Holly options, and no book tours. What the Kantos lacked in sales, it made up for in negative reviews. "Indecipherable, archaic, irrelevant to all current concerns," said the Times book section. M. Silenus has committed the ultimate act of non-communication, wrote Urban Capri in the TC2 review, by indulging himself in an orgy of pretentious obfuscation. Marmon Hamlet, on AllNet Now, issued the final death blow. Oh, the poetry thing from What's-His-Name. Couldn't read it, didn't try. Terenna Wingreen Fief did not seem concerned. 2 weeks after the first reviews and hard fax returns came in, a day after my 13-day binge ended, I farcast to her office and threw myself into the black flow foam chair which crouched in the center of the room like a velvet panther. One of Tau Ceti Center's legendary thunderstorms was going on, and Jovian-sized lightning crashes were rending the blood-tinged air just beyond the invisible containment field. "Don't sweat it," said Tyrena. This week's fashions included a hairdo which sent black spikes thrusting half a meter above her forehead, and a body field opacitor which left shifting currents of color concealing and revealing the nudity beneath. The first run only amounted to 60,000 fax transmits, so we're not out much there. "You said 70 million were planned," I said. "Yeah, well, we changed our minds after Transline's resident AI read it." I slumped lower in the flow foam. "Even the AI hated it?" "The AI loved it," said Terenna. "That's when we knew for sure that people were going to hate it." I sat up. "Couldn't we have sold copies to the Technocore?" "We did," said Tyrena. "One." "The millions of AIs there probably real-time shared it the minute it came in over Fatline. Interstellar copyright doesn't mean shit when you're dealing with silicon." "All right," I said, slumping. "What next?" Outside, lightning bolts the size of old Earth's ancient superhighways danced between the corporate spires and cloud towers. Terenna rose from her desk and walked to the edge of the carpeted circle. Her body field flickered like electrically charged oil on water. "Next," she said, "you decide if you want to be a writer or the world web's biggest jerk-off."
"What?"
"You heard me." Terenna turned and smiled. Her teeth had been capped to gold points. "The contract allows us to recover the advance in any way we have to. Seizing your assets at Interbank, recovering the gold coins you've got hidden on Homefree, and selling that gaudy Farcaster house would about do it. And then you can go join the other artistic dilettantes and dropouts and mental cases that Sad King Billy collects on whatever outback world he lives on." I stared. "Then again," she said, and smiled her cannibal smile, "we can just forget this temporary setback, and you can get to work on your next book." My next book appeared 5 standard months later. The Dying Earth 2 picked up where the Dying Earth left off, in plain prose this time. The sentence length and chapter content carefully guided by neurobio-monitored responses on a test group of 638 average hard fax readers. The book was in novel form, short enough not to intimidate the potential buyer at Food Mart checkout stands, and the cover was a 20-second interactive hollow, wherein the tall, swarthy stranger Amalfi Schwartz, I suppose, though Amalfi was short and pale and wore corrective lenses, rips the bodice of the struggling female just to the nipple line before the protesting blonde turns toward the viewer and cries for help in a breathless whisper, provided by Porn Holly star Lita Swan. Dying Earth 2 sold 19 million copies.
"Not bad," said Terenna. "It takes a while to build an audience."
"The first Dying Earth sold 3 billion copies," I said.
"Pilgrim's Progress," she said. "Mein Kampf. Once in a century. Maybe less."
"But it sold 3 billion.
"Look," said Tyrena. "In 20th century old Earth, a fast food chain took dead cow meat, fried it in grease, added carcinogens, wrapped it in petroleum-based foam, and sold 900 billion units.
Human beings. Go figure.
Dying Earth 3 introduced the characters of Winona, the escaped slave girl who rose to the ownership of her own fiberplastic plantation. Never mind that fiberplastic never grew on old Earth. Arturo Redgrave, the dashing blockade runner.
What blockade?
And Innocence Sperry, the 9-year-old telepath dying of an unspecified Little Nell disease. Innocence lasted until Dying Earth 9, and on the day Transline allowed me to kill the little shit off, I went out to celebrate with a 6-day, 20-world binge. I awoke in a lung pipe on Heaven's Gate, covered with vomit and rebreather mold, nursing the web's biggest headache and the sure knowledge that I soon would have to start on Volume 10 of The Chronicles of the Dying Earth. It isn't hard being a hack writer. Between Dying Earth 2 and Dying Earth 9, 6 standard years had passed relatively painlessly. My research was meager, my plots formulaic, my characters cardboard, my prose preliterate, and my free time was my own. I traveled. I married twice more. Each wife left me with no hard feelings, but with a sizable portion of the royalties from my next Dying Earth. I explored religions and serious drinking, finding more hope of lasting solace in the latter. I kept my home, adding 6 rooms on 5 worlds, and filled it with fine art. I entertained. Writers were among my acquaintances, but at all times we tended to mistrust and badmouth each other, secretly resenting the other's successes and finding fault in their work. Each of us knew in his or her heart that he or she was a true artist of the word who merely happened to be commercial. The others were hacks. Then, on a cool morning, with my sleeping room rocking slightly in the upper branches of my tree on the Templar world, I awoke to a gray sky and the realization that my muse had fled. It had been 5 years since I had written any poetry. The Cantus lay open in the Deneb Dry Tower, only a few pages finished beyond what had been published. I had been using thought processors to write my novels, and one of these activated as I entered the study. Shit, it printed out. What did I do with my muse? It says something about the type of writing I had been doing, that my muse could flee without my noticing. For those who do not write, and who never have been stirred by the creative urge, talk of muses seems a figure of speech, a quaint conceit. But for those of us who live by the word, our muses are as real and necessary as the soft clay of language which they help to sculpt. When one is writing, really writing, it is as if one is given a fat line to the gods. No true poet has been able to explain the exhilaration one feels when the mind becomes an instrument, as surely as does the pen or thought processor, ordering and expressing the revelations flowing in
from somewhere else. My muse had fled. I sought her in the other worlds of my house, but only silence echoed back from the art-bedecked walls and empty spaces. I farcast and flew to my favorite places, watching the suns set on the wind-blown prairies of grass and the night fogs obscure the ebony crags of Nevermore. But although I emptied my mind of the trash prose of the endless dying earth, there came no whispers from my muse. I sought her in alcohol and flashback, returning to the productive days on Heaven's Gate, when her inspiration was a constant buzzing in my ears, interrupting my work, waking me from sleep. But in the relived hours and days, her voice was as muted and garbled as a damaged audio disc from some forgotten century. My muse had fled. I farcast to Terenna Wingreenthief's office at the precise moment of my appointment. Terenna had been promoted from editor-in-chief of the Hard Facts Division to publisher. Her new office occupied the highest level of the Tau Ceti Center transline spire, and standing there was like perching on the carpeted summit of the galaxy's tallest, thinnest peak. Only the invisible dome of the slightly polarized containment field arched overhead, and the edge of the carpet ended in a 6-kilometer drop. I wondered if other authors felt the urge to jump. "The new opus?" said Terenna. Lussus was dominating the fashion universe this week, and dominate was the right word. My editor was dressed in leather and iron, rusted spikes on her wrists and neck, and a massive bandolier across her shoulder and left breast. The cartridges looked real. "Yeah," I said, and tossed the manuscript box on her desk. "Martin, Martin, Martin," she sighed, "when are you going to transmit your books rather than going to all of the trouble of printing them out and bringing them here in person?" "There's a strange satisfaction in delivering them," I said, "especially this one." "Oh?" "Yes," I said. "Why don't you read some of it?" Terenna smiled and clicked black fingernails along the cartridges in her bandolier. "I'm sure it's up to your usual high standards, Martin," she said, "but I don't have to look at it." "Please, do," I said. "Really," said Terenna, "there's no reason. It always makes me nervous to read a new work while the author is present." "This one won't," I said. "Read just the first few pages." She must have heard something in my voice, because she frowned slightly and opened the box. The frown deepened as she read the first page and flipped through the rest of the manuscript. Page 1 had a single sentence. "And then, one fine morning in October, the dying earth swallowed its own bowels, spasmed its final spasm, and died." The other 299 pages were blank. "A joke, Martin?"
"Nope."
"A subtle hint, then?"
"You would like to begin a new series?"
"Nope." "It's not as if we hadn't expected it, Martin. Our storyliners have come up with several exciting series ideas for you. M. Sabwezi thinks that you would be perfect for the novelizations of the Crimson Avenger Hollies."
"You can stick the Crimson Avenger up your corporate ass, Terenna," I said cordially. "I'm finished with Transline, and this premasticated gruel you call fiction." Terenna's expression did not flicker. Her teeth were not pointed. Today they were rusted iron to match the spikes on her wrists and the collar around her neck. "Martin, Martin, Martin," she sighed, "you have no idea how finished you will be if you don't apologize, straighten up, and fly right. But that can wait until tomorrow. Why don't you step home, sober up, and think about this?" I laughed. I'm as sober as I've been in 8 years, lady. It just took me a while to realize that it wasn't just me who's writing crap. There's not a book published in the web this year that hasn't been total garbage. Well, I'm getting off the scow.
Terenna rose. For the first time, I noticed that on her simulated canvas web belt there hung a Force death wand. I hoped that it was a designer fake, as the rest of her costume.
"Listen, you miserable no-talent hack," she hissed. "Transline owns you from the balls up. If you give us any more trouble, we'll have you working in the Gothic Romance Factory under the name Rosemary Titmouse. Now go home, sober up, and get to work on Dying Earth 10."
I smiled and shook my head. Terenna squinted slightly.
"You're still into us for almost a million mark advance," she said. "One word to collections, and we'll seize every room of your house except that goddamn raft you use as an outhouse. You can sit on it until the oceans fill up with crap."
I laughed a final time. "It's a self-contained disposal unit," I said. "Besides, I sold the house yesterday. The check for the balance of the advance should have been transmitted by now."
Terenna tapped the plastic grip of her death wand. "Transline's copyrighted the Dying Earth concept, you know. We'll just have someone else write the books."
I nodded. "They're welcome to it."
Something in my ex-editor's voice changed when she realized that I was serious. Somewhere, I sensed there was an advantage to her if I stayed.
"Listen," she said, "I'm sure we can work this out, Martin. I was saying to the director the other day that your advances were too small, and that Transline should let you develop a new storyline."
"Terenna, Terenna, Terenna," I sighed. "Goodbye." I farcast to Renaissance Vector, and then to Parsimony, where I boarded a spinship for the 3-week voyage to Asquith and the crowded kingdom of Sad King Billy.
Notes for a sketch of Sad King Billy.
"His Royal Highness King William the 23rd, Sovereign Lord of the Kingdom of Windsor in Exile, looks a bit like a wax candle of a man who has been left on a hot stove. His long hair runs in limp rivulets to slumped shoulders, while the furrows on his brow trickle downward to the tributaries of wrinkles around the basset hound eyes, and then run southward again through folds and frown lines to the maze of wattles in neck and jowls. King Billy is said to remind anthropologists of the worry dolls of the outback Kinshasa, to make Zen Gnostics recall the pitiful Buddha after the temple fire on Taizin, and to send media historians rushing to their archives to check photos of an ancient flat-film movie actor named Charles Lawton. None of these references mean anything to me. I look at King Billy and think of my long-dead tutor, Don Balthazar, after a week-long binge. Sad King Billy's reputation for gloominess is exaggerated. He often laughs. It is merely his misfortune that his peculiar form of laughter makes most people think he is sobbing. A man cannot help his physiognomy, but in His Highness's case, the entire persona tends to suggest either buffoon or victim. He dresses, if that can be the word, in something approaching a constant state of anarchy, defying the taste and color